Let's continue on learning a little bit more from Proverbs today. I hope this is being useful. I hope it's being meaningful to you. Again, I don't know everything there is to know. I'm a student of the Bible like you, and I've just been on the road a little longer than some of you maybe, and I'm just sharing what we can find here. We're going to go to Proverbs chapter 3. We ended with chapter 2 yesterday, and we're just going to keep moving through this prologue or introduction of sorts. And again, this is setting up for what is going to follow in the rest of the book of Proverbs. So kind of remember that. In chapter 3, here's what we have in the content of chapter 3. If I can give you sort of like a subtitle or a topic, kind of help you understand, it's helpful to me and I with these things I found. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 35, that's the entirety of the chapter. Essentially, we have this admonition from father to son to follow the way of wisdom in relationships, in all our relationships. Let's just put it that way. And of course, that would mean with God and with people. This chapter, the father talks to son a little more specifically about how to relate to God, how to relate to people. Verse 1 through 4, chapter 3, we have this introductory exhortation. You could say the father's being, constantly he's being upbeat, he's exhorting, he's admonishing, he's encouraging. And that doesn't mean you don't warn. It doesn't mean you don't get rather blunt at times in your exhortation. Exhortations, in my experience, are not always sugar-coated. And the father here, it seems to be at times, you're going to see as we move along, he gets rather frank with his son. And sometimes it happens when dads have talks with their sons and mothers with daughters and so on. He says here, verse 1 through 4, this introduction exhortation to this chapter, he says, "My son, do not forget my law, but let your heart keep my commands. For length of days and long life and peace they will add to you. Let not mercy and truth forsake you. Bind them around your neck." Keep them close. "Write them on the tablet of your heart, and so find favor and high esteem in the sight of God and man." So the father is exhorting the son. It's interesting, he says, "Do not forget my law, let your heart keep my commands." The father's law and commands are based on God's law and commands. And of course, we could step back and look at this in parallel. Easily we can hear the voice of our Heavenly Father talking to us as well. And so we always have that parallel going along here, it seems, with Proverbs. Maybe not perfectly all the time, but we definitely can draw that in, that parallel. And so he said, "Admonish father to follow the father's teaching because it will give you a long and happy life." Is that always a guarantee? Well, I don't know. I've known some people that don't live quite as long, and they were, I guess they were good people too. But that's in God's hands. Definitely we tend to have a better life and potential for a longer life when we do follow God's law, when we do get along with our parents' teaching, and if it's based, especially if it's based in God's law, we'll get along with them, with our family, and with others more without a doubt. Verse 3 through 4, faithfulness, mercy, and truth. Faithfulness to mercy and truth brings honor from God and men. I don't know if you've experienced how good it feels when you're an honest, hardworking person, you have a job, and you do your best. And we don't do it necessarily just to get accolades from employers and others, but we do it because it's the way of life we've been taught. And doesn't it feel good when people recognize our character, when people recognize you're an honest employee? And part of what we're going to get to here is that the idea that the father's trying to express to his son, protect your reputation, protect your name. Your name is who you are. And one of the worst things that can happen to us as individuals, and this is something that's carried through in our Western culture as well, is the importance of your name, your reputation, your name in the mouths of others. It's very important. And if you are faithful, if you practice mercy and truth, justice, if you keep God's law, people may not know why you're such a good person or why you're so dependable, but they will recognize the fruits of what you're doing. They will recognize the fruits of your character, the choices you make to follow in the ways of godly wisdom. And that's what we get to in verse 4. "And so you will find favor and high esteem in the sight of God and of man." And speaking as a dad, it's really encouraging personally when I've seen my own kids try to do things the right way and then they get recognized. And I'm sure many of you, if you talk to your parents and grandparents and people that know you, they'll say the same thing. It's very gratifying as a parent to know and to see that your own children, quite possibly in time, your own grandchildren, if you should be so fortunate to have any, you'll see them walking in the ways of God. And it's a very comforting and encouraging feeling to see that. Verse 5 through 12, we continue, and here we have more admonitions, more encouragement from father to son to be faithful to God in particular. And he gives us some tips here to his son. And I guess I should say too, although this is a father speaking to a son, to his young son, whether you're old or whether you're a woman, a little girl in time, whatever, these same bits of wisdom apply to all of us. Remember, it's for all people, but it's also more narrowly focused in the context of this story. Now, if you're wondering, well, when does God just speak to women primarily and then the men are kind of the standing on the side? We'll get to one of those examples. Not in this book, but in another book. So here we have admonition to be faithful to God. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your paths. Notice it says in all your ways, not just in getting a job, not just in choosing a college degree, not just in finding a mate, but in all your ways and all the choices you make in life. It's never wrong to ask God's direction and guidance and help. And it also encourages us here, verse 5, to trust totally in God. God is the one that is the source of our true success, and He will grant us success. Verse 7, going on verse 7 and 8, do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord. There's that theme. Fear the Lord, revere Him, and depart from evil. Depart would also encourage us with the idea of repent from evil ways, turn around. It will be health to your flesh and strength to your bones. And so here, we're told to trust, verse 5 and 6, here in 7 and 8, we're told to be humbly reverent of God and to avoid evil. To depart tells us that it's our choice. God is not going to make us obey Him. He's not going to scare us away from obeying Him either, but we have a choice. And of course, we're reminded a right relationship with God begins with obedience and humility and submitting to Him. Verse 9:10, honor the Lord with your possessions and with the first fruits of all your increase, so that your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will overflow with new wine. What is he talking about here? Honor the Lord with your possessions, with the first fruits of your increase. How do we do that today? What is he talking about? Tithing. We need to tithe. In one way, God is... when we read Scripture, we're more or less told, you know, God tells us, prove me whether I'll bless you or not if you give me the first of your increase. I know teaching little kids sometimes when they do a little chore and say, okay, here's a dollar, now you need to put 10 cents of that away towards in another little bank or whatever, that's going to be your tithe to God. But it's mine, you know. But you start young. And then, it becomes, they're obeying, they don't quite understand, they obey. But then in time, they're able to understand a little bit more, and then they actually come to want to do it. You know, then there comes a question, well, Dad, is this income or is this a gift? Because, you know, gifts you don't necessarily have to tithe on. And I usually say, well, if it's a blessing, it's a gift, how do you think God would be pleased with you giving a little of your gift? You know, so I even do that with my kids, and I don't make them tithe on gifts. I think maybe some of you know that's not necessarily income per se. We didn't work for it. But that usually happens when grandma or grandpa gives them something in the mail. They don't ask me that question anymore. Verse 9 through 10. So we're to willingly tithe. We should gladly do it. And it's a way of honoring God. And it is an act of faith. I remember when I was first a very, very poor student, God was first calling me. I was a college student. I was a junior in college, and I finally started acting on God's call. And it was hard to tithe because it leaving me maybe $5 a week to live on. That was okay. You know, I learned that I didn't need to eat ice cream like the other students. I can get by on a free glass of ice water while the movie was playing. You know, And then when you get along in years, you look back and recognize there's so many things that happened along the way. I did not really deserve it. I recognize I haven't earned these things. And I like to believe it is because I trusted God and did what he said. And that's something I still need to keep doing. I don't want to get lazy about it and get lackadaisical. Verse 11 through 12, another exhortation here, an admonition from the father to son. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor detest his correction. For whom the Lord loves, he corrects. That's a promise. Just as a father, the son in whom he delights. Sometimes people have this idea that God is this cruel, wicked, almost wicked, avenging God. He's just out there to crush us under his almighty heel, you know. That's not the God I know. The God I know corrects and disciplines us as a loving father would the son he loves. And I often, when I've been corrected and chastened, you might say, sometimes I feel like I definitely get what I deserve. Or maybe at times I feel, wow, it could have been a lot worse. Thank you for your mercy. You know, so I think the father here is reminding his son that it's okay when things don't go well, when you feel like you're being corrected for a wrong choice or a slip of backsliding and not doing what you know to do. Sometimes that occurs as tough times. Sometimes you might feel maybe that's because things didn't go what you wanted. The point is, no matter what happens, we need to remain loyal and faithful to God. When my mom and dad would swat me or take something away from me as a kid, we didn't grow up in the church, I never for a minute thought that my parents didn't love me. You know, I was disciplined, but I never thought they didn't love me. I may not have felt that way at the moment, I will admit that, but looking back, I recognize they did that, and I'm grateful that they did discipline me. I'm sure I wouldn't be the person I am today if they hadn't. Same way with God's chastening us. I think it helps us recognize God chastens us because he wants us to become better than we might feel that we can be. God sees our potential. Our potential is to be born with these glorious immortal spirit bodies, in his kingdom, be part of salvation. That's our potential, and he wants to do all he can to help us do that. And we will be there if we submit to him and allow him to correct us and to learn from our correction. Father and son. You know, verses 13 through 26, it changes a little bit. Here in this chapter, the father continues to talk to his son. It's still the father talking to his son. But now he shifts to talk a little more specifically about wisdom. And here he explains, again, it's still about relationships in this chapter, but here he's explaining to his son how to have a right relationship with wisdom. Not with wisdom, but with wisdom, as if wisdom were a person. Okay? How to have relationship with godly wisdom, as it were. And I say that because we're going to see wisdom personified here in his discourse to his son. He says, happy, verse 13, happy is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding. For her proceeds, see we have that pronoun her, and the reference, you go back to it, he's talking about wisdom. So suddenly wisdom, this abstraction, he's turning it into as if it were a person, some kind of person or being. For wisdom, her proceeds are better than the profits of silver, and her gain than fine gold. She, wisdom, is more precious than rubies, and all the things you may desire cannot compare with her. Now, I find it interesting that he's speaking to a young person, and maybe I don't mean to push our modern culture into this ancient culture, but young people, when we're young, and just human beings in general, we really like things, don't we? We love our materialism. And we like riches. And a young man starting out, you can imagine, he's wanting to go out there and make his $1 million. He's wanting to get a house. He's wanting to get a car. Maybe back then it was a fancy donkey. I don't know. But, you know, he's trying to do, he's got his mindset, I'm going to get this and this. I'm going to build this house. I'm going to do all this. And the father here is reminding him, not saying those are bad things, but you want to be sure to seek wisdom first. If you pursue wisdom, and maybe that's a lesson we can remember from Solomon's life. He asked for wisdom first, and then what did God bless him with as well?
Riches.
Riches, good reputation, a name, fame, prosperity, all these things. But Solomon asked for wisdom first. Now, later on, remember, he didn't stick with wisdom. His focus moved away from wisdom, moved away from God, and that brought consequences. And so it's interesting, the dad here seems to know what the son, how the son is wired and what he's interested in. But he says, don't forget wisdom. All the things you may desire cannot compare with her. And that is such an important thing for all of us to remember as well. He continues on, verse 16. He says, length of days is in her right hand. Wisdom will give you a long life. In her left hand, riches and honor. So they go together. You'll have a lengthy life. Everybody wants to live a good long life. In the other hand, we'll have riches and honor, your reputation. Her ways are the ways of pleasantness, wisdom. And all of wisdom's paths are peace. She, wisdom, is a tree of life to those who take hold of her. And happy are all who retain her. Now, here's constantly, you got wisdom, and then you got a way of life that is not of wisdom. And yet he stresses over and over again, she is a tree of life to those who take hold of her. You have to reach out and hold her. You have to want her. And happy are all who retain her. You have to keep her. You have to keep wisdom. You don't want to just use wisdom for a few years and then let it go. Again, Solomon's life might be an example of that going on. Of course, tree of life here, I think we could connect a reference to the Garden of Eden. You know, side note, Genesis 3:22. And also in Revelation 22, verse 2, I'm just going to turn there real quick and read that to you. In Revelation 22, verse 2, it reads, from beginning of the Bible to the end, we find this reference to the tree of life. Revelation 22, 2 reads, in the middle of its streets, the city of God, and on either side of the river was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, and each tree yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And then verse 14, of the same chapter of Revelation 22:14, blessed are those who do his commandments that they may have the right to the tree of life and may enter through the gates into the city. So again, tree of life, the idea of commandment keeping, wisdom, it's all interconnected. It's all interconnected. Wisdom will lead us, the suggestion here is wisdom will lead us to eternal life and bliss ultimately. And, of course, ultimately, we'll escape the curse of death. We'll avoid eternal death. Verses 19 through 20, wisdom we find here, it's kind of like an inset idea. It's going to be expanded upon in chapter 8 of Proverbs. But here, the dad is telling the son, the Lord by wisdom founded or established the earth. By understanding, it's related to wisdom, by understanding he established the heavens. By his knowledge the depths were broken up and clouds dropped down the dew. So what's really interesting here is that wisdom is most valuable to God. In fact, God used wisdom in the creation. And if you want to take it a step farther, this same wisdom can direct our lives, also created the universe. And so the wisdom that God uses is the same wisdom the Father's telling the Son, you need to use this wisdom. That is something to really think about. And it gets hard to think too far because it's so big for me to grasp at times. But the same wisdom God used in the creating everything is the same wisdom he offers to us. He wants us to take and use and live by. In verse 21 through 26, the Father continues to exhort his son, telling him that, you know, if you follow godly wisdom, you will have a good and happy life. We would hasten to add from our knowledge of Job's life, doesn't mean you won't have troubles, but your life is going to be a whole lot more happy, more steady. You'll have more hope in your life. You'll have more to look forward to if you do keep wisdom and live according to it. Let's read here, verse 21, 26. My son, let them refers to the wisdom, understanding, knowledge that we read about in verses 19 through 20. My son, let them not depart from your eyes, these ways of wisdom. Keep sound wisdom and discretion. That's the choices, the discernment we can make, the choices we make using wisdom. So they will be life to your soul and grace to your neck. Again, it'll be it's a chain of honor, of adornment, of recognition. It's something valuable. It's not something around your neck that's going to wear you down and ruin you or shackle you. It's not that kind of grace, a chain around your neck, a reference back to Proverbs 1, verse 8. Verse 23, then you will walk, if you follow wisdom, then you will walk safely in your way and your foot will not stumble. When you lie down, you will not be afraid. Yes, you will lie down and your sleep will be sweet. And I don't know if you're old enough to have sleepless nights yet when you fret about things. I'm sure you do. Even if you know you got a big problem the next day you got to face, somehow knowing that you're close to God and God is in charge of your life, and you know no matter what happens tomorrow, it's going to be okay. That's wisdom. And that allows you to get some, allows you to sleep a little bit better at night. And there's, so there is truth to what he's saying here. Verse 25, he continues on. He says, with wisdom, he says, do not be afraid of sudden terror, nor of trouble from the wicked when it comes. Is that interesting? He's telling his son, you're going to have trouble someday. The wicked out there are going to afflict you. They're going to make your life a little miserable at times. But you don't need to be afraid of it. You don't need to be in fear of the wicked times or evil times. And of course, we live in evil times still today. We need to be concerned. We can pray about it. We can do what we can to wisely avoid the wrong paths of life. But bad things are going to happen to us. The wicked will maybe persecute us someday or something. But we're told even here, father to son in the book of Proverbs, don't be troubled by that. Hold on to wisdom. For, verse 26, for because the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught. So yeah, there's going to be traps in life. There are going to be things you get caught in a corner, it seems, but don't worry about that. Let your confidence remain in the Lord, the source of true wisdom. Be humble, fear God, revere Him, keep making right choices, and you'll be safe. And you will be safe. There's a lot of promises here in verse 21 through 26. A lot of promises the Father tells His Son. And so wisdom dictates confidence in God. And notice that the confidence should not be in yourself. Wisdom dictates that we put our confidence in God and not in ourself. Verse 27 through 30, here we shift to a few statements of wisdom about how to practice love towards neighbor. The way of wisdom with neighbor is the way of love. In essence, verses 27 through 30 reminds us, the Father, the Son as well, we are our brother's keeper. We are our brother's keeper. In that sense, who is our brother? Everybody. We are our neighbor's keeper. Verse 27, do not withhold good from those to whom it is due, when it is in the power of your hand to do so. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come back, and tomorrow I will give it, when you have it with you right then. In other words, he's saying, if you can do somebody good and they've asked you for help and you know you could do it, then do it. Don't postpone doing good. My experience in postponing doing good and saying, well, I'll help you tomorrow. Tomorrow comes and maybe I don't have that opportunity. And maybe by then, the person that was disappointed now dislikes me, and I've ruined the relationship because I didn't help them when they needed instead of when it was convenient for me. You understand? So part of living by wisdom, you could see here, part of wisdom is this idea of self-sacrifice. Of course, we hear a lot about that in the Bible, not only in the Old Testament, but especially in the New Testament. It is a reasonable service. Romans 12:1, Paul talks about it's reasonable to live a life of love towards God and love towards neighbor. Do not devise, verse 29, do not devise evil against your neighbor, for he dwells by you for safety's sake. And do not strive with a man without cause if he has done you no harm. And those two verses again remind me that we are a brother's keeper. You know, don't plot against your neighbor. Maybe he keeps taking your parking spot. City living can be that way, you know, little petty things. Well, work it out. Talk to them. I don't know. But don't cause trouble. The idea here, as we're taught in the New Testament as well, do all that you can to live at peace with your neighbor. You know, do what you can. It's an ancient idea. It's a modern idea. Do what you can to get along with people. Don't strive with a man without cause. Don't go causing trouble with people. It's not fun when people like to pick a fight. People pick fights with us at times. We don't go looking for them, but they seem to like looking for them. But we shouldn't do that. Just because people treat us badly, it's very clear wisdom dictates we don't return that evil in return. That's not the way we're to live. Do not strive with a man without cause if he has done you no harm. Now, I guess I would suggest if people are trying to punch you in your face, well, you better protect yourself. You better get away. Get out of the situation you're in. But don't go, if you know it's going to happen, I wouldn't go looking for trouble, per se. Verse 31 through 35, as we conclude chapter 3, here he shifts to tell his son, kind of concluding his discussion here in this section, whatever you do, do not envy the ways of the wicked. And sometimes that's hard, isn't it? Sometimes it's hard not to be envious of people. You know, maybe you didn't get to play, maybe you went to public school and you never got to be on varsity team, whatever, because they had games Friday night and you chose to keep the Sabbath instead. And so it didn't seem fair. You're trying to live the right way and that you don't get to do it, everybody else does, and you can become envious. You can be a little jealous at times. Don't feel that way. That probably wasn't the greatest example, but you get the idea. You can think back to your own years, kind of the feelings you have and the feelings we still will have at time. That old idea, why do the wicked prosper? Verse 31, do not envy the oppressor and choose none of his ways. You want a good reason why you don't want to choose any of the wicked ways? For the perverse person is an abomination to the Lord. God is not with the wicked. God is not with the foolish of the world who say there is no God and think anybody that believes that is kind of a religious nut. Well, I don't mind being called a religious nut. It doesn't harm my faith at all. God is well pleased with the upright. The perverse person is an abomination to God. And now watch here. If you look here, verses 32 through 35, we get a series of antithetical parallelism. You want a good example of how parallelism works? The contrast. Line A and B are different. Line A and B are different verse after verse. You get a beautiful example here. Let's start again in verse 32. For the perverse person is an abomination to the Lord, but His, God's secret counsel, is with the upright. The curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked, but He blesses the home of the just. Surely He, God, scorns the scornful, but God gives grace to the humble. See all these contrasts. In verse 35, the wise shall inherit glory. That's pretty incredible when you think of the promise of salvation. Hinted at here in Proverbs. The wise shall inherit glory, but shame shall be the legacy of fools. So again, these are great examples of that antithetical parallelism. And it really sets up the sharp contrast between these two paths, these two ways of life the Father consistently is teaching His Son about. And again, verse 35 tells us, God will judge all men. And we should not doubt it. We should not doubt it. Okay, that's chapter 3. Any thoughts or comments? Anything any of you would like to share? Micah? Okay, you got a microphone? I think we're hooked up. We better hear what you're saying.
Is that like kind of a brief off-topic question? It's very brief.
Off-topic questions are not always brief. They're often off-topic. Go ahead.
Okay.
Yes, if I don't want to answer it, I won't.
It's just about the time period of this. It's on the paper here. It says that could not have been completed until 700 BC. Was Solomon even alive at that point? Because then it says Proverbs written by Solomon would have been 971 to 931. Yeah. So to jump to 700 is very
Yeah. If you go to that verse, what is it? Proverbs 22, verse 1. Is that what I put on there on the handout? What I'm referring to there, Micah, maybe I wasn't clear yesterday. The book as we have it, the entire book of Proverbs, what we now list as chapter 1 through 31. They didn't have chapters back then, of course. What that tells us is that Hezekiah's men found more of Solomon's Proverbs. So it's like they found another little collection, and they added it. Hezekiah reigned around that time period, 700 BC, roughly two centuries after Solomon. Isn't that incredible when you think about it? So the core of the book of Proverbs, like what we're reading now, scholars seem to believe this definitely was written by Solomon, and this was the original part of the original collection that he would have written during his, probably his reign, 971 to 931. He reigned 4 years. And then it seems that centuries later, when King Hezekiah reigned, some of his men, Hezekiah had revival. That helps. Sort of a revival. They turned back to God. And they're nosing around in the temple, it seems, and they may have found this scroll, more of Solomon's Proverbs, stuck away somewhere, and they pulled it out, and they recognized what it was. And then they added it to what we now have. So that's why I say it as early as 971, scholars thinking as late as 700, that this complete book of Proverbs was written. Does that clarify it? That was a good question. I'm glad you let me clarify. That wasn't so far off topic. It was still on Proverbs. that was good. That was safe. Okay. Any other thoughts or comments? Those are good questions. Are you beginning to feel like you're oozing with wisdom? You're awfully quiet. And I've learned that's either because I've scared people or I've bored them. Which is it? Giving you food for thought? Okay, I hope so. All right, well, let's continue on. Chapter 4, Proverbs. Here it's kind of cool. When I came across this, and I just really kind of focused on this, and I wish I'd learned this more of this when I was your age, what I'm covering with you now. What's that old saying? It's an old Danish saying, too soon old, too late smart, something like that. Yeah. Too soon old, too late smart. I wish I were smarter decades ago. But the point is, you learn what you learn and apply it as soon as you can. Verses 1 through 9 of Proverbs 4, it's very interesting. Because what we learn here is that something you may not have thought about, but wisdom should be like a family heirloom. What do I mean by heirloom? Yeah, Sam? Things that get passed down. Maybe you're hoping, ladies, to get maybe a piece of your great-grandmother's jewelry that's been in your family. Maybe you're the only daughter and you'll get some of that. The guys may be hoping for dad's old classic car that sits out in the garage. You know, that's the heirloom. But what you can have, and what we're going to learn here, is wisdom. Wisdom should be thought of as an heirloom you pass down from generation to generation, father to son, father to son. Now that, to me, and I read that, it's like, whoa, that was cool. I really like that idea. And it kind of gives us a focus as parents, grandparents, and future parents and grandparents. So let's look here, verse 1 through 9. Hear my children. Oh, what happened? Now he shifted to plural. My children. Hear my children, the instruction of a father, and give attention to no understanding. For I give you good doctrine. Do not forsake my law. Do not forsake my instruction, he's saying. Now look at this, verses 3 through 9. When I was my father's son, tender and the only one in the sight of my mother, he, my father, also taught me. Now, this is kind of interesting because if Solomon... Here, if we want to insert Solomon into this picture more specifically, we could imagine this being Solomon talking about he was tender and the only one inside of his mother, Bathsheba, And he taught me, meaning David, his father David, quite possibly. It's quite possible. Of course, it can all be kind of rather fictional in some ways too, but I think it may quite be real. Father to son. In other words, the dad's teaching his son what the son's grandfather taught him. It's an heirloom. He also taught me and said to me, let your heart retain my words, keep my commands and live. Get wisdom, get understanding. You really, you know, I get it. Do not forsake nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her, wisdom, and she will preserve you. Now, this is interesting too, verses 6 through 9, because we start shifting. We're still talking about wisdom, but now the qualities that describe wisdom become a little more interesting. And oh, look at this. Do not forsake her, and she will preserve you. Love her, and she will keep you. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And in all of your getting, understanding, young men love to get things, right? In all of your getting, get understanding. Exalt her wisdom, and she will promote you. She will bring you honor when you embrace her. What does embrace mean? Well, physically, you're going to hug her. Hold her close to your heart. And she will place on your head an ornament of grace, a crown of glory she will deliver to you. And so a number of points here. An example of wisdom and understanding being passed down from one generation to the next. We get this sense that one of the key places, perhaps one of the most best places to learn wisdom is within the family, is at home. Why are stable homes and families so important? It's because when you have a stable home environment, when you got a loving mom and dad, or even just one diligent and loving parent, sometimes that's what we have in life. But if you get that sort of love and a parent that takes time to teach you, to give you this most precious heirloom of wisdom, you are truly blessed. It's something to be handed down. And so again, you know, we think, well, what things are passed down from generation to generation in your family? I think the best thing to pass down, according to this, is the wisdom. And I'd throw in a few of your family stories. Some of the stories about grandma and grandpa to your kids one day or whatever. Those are part of our heirlooms. Those are meaningful things too. But look at verse 6. The father now shifts back to the personification of wisdom as a woman. And what strikes me, because I've read ahead to the end of the book, wisdom begins to take on some wifely, that's my word, wifely qualities, practically. She will be protective. She will be helpful. She will be life-sustaining. Now, I'm kind of giving it away, but it's always nice to know where we're going. But when you get to Proverbs 31, we're going to read about the virtuous woman, and she is a wife, by the way. And her qualities are very similar to what the father describes here about wisdom. And he even tells the son, he says, in some ways, I guess you could say it wifely. That's a word I made up. I don't think that's a real adverb or adjective. But we could throw in the word, she's like a wife. Wisdom can almost, you might say, is somewhat maternal as well. She has these motherly qualities, protective, helpful, strengthening. Moms watch out for us. And so it's interesting, he talks about how you need to embrace her, you need to love wisdom. That is all about a relationship, isn't it? For this young man would recognize there's only two women you would have a relationship like this. And I would still say there are only two women in your life you should have a relationship like this, the closest relationship. Who are they going to be, young men? Your wife and your mom. To be embracing, to be so intimate with any other woman, you've just crossed a line. And isn't that interesting? It should be with the wife. It should be with your mom. And of course, young men, we learn elsewhere in the Bible, there comes a time to leave home. You know, if you choose to be married, there's a time to leave home and to love your wife. So I thought it's interesting. The wisdom starts taking on qualities here under the father's description to his son. He almost has this wife-like qualities, and then you can, relate it to a wife having this maternal, mother-like qualities as well. And again, father to son, that would be a description that would be attractive to a young man. He's wanting to get out in life. And in this culture, in that ancient day, yes, I guess somewhat like today, you have a skill set. You want to make sure as a young man that you have some way to make a living, to provide for a wife and family, and then you want to find a good wife. Back then, the parents were highly involved in choosing a bride for you and helping you find a bride. That is not so much our tradition today. Although I think it's a good idea if your parents like your spouse to be, male, ladies, guys, I think that helps. Parents know us more, often know us better than we know ourselves. Okay, any thoughts or questions on that? Morgan?
Several times it's been mentioned that wisdom is like, wisdom brings life. And physically that makes sense because it's like practical and it'll bring success and literally life. But I was wondering, like, on a spiritual level, since really the only source of eternal life is like through Jesus Christ and being baptized and accepting Him and through God's grace, there's nothing we can do. Kind of just, and I kind of understand, I guess, that gift should produce in us, you know, works of wisdom, I guess. Is there any, I mean, could you expound on that maybe? Like how the only way we have eternal life spiritually is through, is a gift, but wisdom also can bring life. I mean, is there a spiritual connection, I guess? Because I understand it physically, it's just, not that I have this huge conflict. I kind of think I understand how they're related. I was just wondering if you had some more insight.
So are you thinking of how we understand as Christians, there's that God calls, the process, repentance, baptism, receiving God's Holy Spirit, laying on of hands. How does that equate with the Old Testament here? Proverbs was talking about wisdom. It's kind of a physical thing. And so you're seeing, there's kind of like a gap. Is that what you're seeing if you look at strictly from the Old Testament?
Kind of. I mean, I could kind of see some ways that connect, but...
Well, I would say, you know, look at the life of King David. Was King David baptized? Did he go through the same process to receive God's Spirit? Obviously, he must have had God's Spirit. You know, that's where David's called a prophet, okay? And Paul later on is going to say his heart was like God's, okay? There comes obedience, believing God, obeying God, and you begin to put on the mind of God, okay? God can give His Spirit to whomever He chooses, however He chooses, I guess, is what partly I would say to that. But key is you're turning your life to God, and that requires choosing to embrace wisdom. And wisdom is founded on humility, a reverence for God. You know, David obviously must have kept God's physical commandments. You know, he kept them literally as best he could, let's say. And when he made some sins, and he made some big ones, he repented. But yet he never gave up on God. He never stopped going to God. He's the one that said, do not take away from me your spirit. Right? Psalm 51, I believe it's where that is. So I think there is a relationship that will develop even in the process as we understand it. Since Christ has come, it seems to be a little different from what we saw in the Old Testament. But God is still God, and He will still give His Spirit and a right heart to those who are willing to obey Him, to live their lives as best as they know. That's why I try to be cautious about, I don't stand here in judgment of other people that maybe they're not in United Church of God, or they're not in a Church of God. Maybe they're people that know nothing about our history of Church of God or whatever. Because God's going to do what He's going to do. That's not up to me. And so I just try to be very circumspect at how I look at life. I don't know if I just taught heresy here. I don't intend to. But all I know is that God is God and I am me, and I'm not going to confuse the two. All right, well, let's keep moving forward. And let's see, we are still in chapter 4, yes? I may be doing a little skipping here at times. Let's look at verses 10 through 13. Again, by now, I think we get the idea. The father keeps telling the son this way or that way. What has been your experience with people that keep repeating things to you? Why do we do this? For emphasis, we all will come to a point, yeah, yeah, yada, yada, yada. Yep, you keep saying that, I know. Yada means I know, by the way. I know, I know, I know. The point is, it is for emphasis. And be careful complaining about repetition. Because when you get to a certain point and you step back and look at the Bible, God's Word, God's inspired Word, things He's been consistently saying, apparently since the beginning of human history, Genesis, and on through to Revelation, it's a lot of repetition. So I tell myself that sometimes. Be careful of being tired or feeling tired of repetition. There's a reason for that. And so we do see the Father telling His Son over and over again. That is the way it's structured, and that is reflected throughout Scripture as well. Verse 10 through 13, "Hear, my Son, and receive my sayings. And the years of your life will be many. I have taught you in the way of wisdom. I have led you in right paths. When you walk, your steps will not be hindered. When you run, you will not stumble. Take firm hold of instruction. Do not let go. Keep her, for she is your life." There are only two choices ultimately in life: wisdom or not wisdom. Life or death. You want to throw in some other words? Blessing or cursing. Okay, it's... And people say, oh, that's so black and white. Yeah, I didn't write the book. And that's ultimately what it comes down to. And ultimately, and that's what I try to remember anytime we are all tempted by sin, when you get a choice to do the right thing or the wrong thing, you got to come back to that. Do I obey God even though I don't want to obey God in this particular situation, or do I not obey God? That's really what happens when we're tempted. The Father to Son says, repeats over and over again, there are only two paths, one right and one wrong. We like having many choices. We want 31 flavors. I think they're up to 39 now. Ice cream. No, you only get two choices here with God, the way of life or the way of death. And so the Father, it's interesting, you look here at verse 11 as well. The Father says, I have taught you in the way of wisdom. I have led you in right paths. As parents, we've got to make sure we set the right example for our kids. You got to make sure you tell your kids when you're wrong. You got to make sure you apologize to your children when you make mistakes. You got to allow your children in a respectful way to let them disagree with you at times, because that's part of being humble. Now, of course, you don't want your children to be disrespectful. You don't want your children to say things like, I hate you. If you're going to say that, you need to be respectful. And then explain to me, why do you feel that way, Johnny? Because we have an opportunity now to talk. Because something's not right. What's going on in our relationship? But notice the Father has set the example. And you get the sense He's setting the example because He got it from His Father. And the idea would be He got it from His Father, and so on. It's a family heirloom, this way of wisdom. But it's your choice, child, whether you want to use this heirloom I preserved and shared with you or not. That's between you and God. Then He conversely talks about the path of wickedness. Verse 14, do not enter the path of the wicked and do not walk in the way of evil. He's very clear and precise to His Son. Avoid it. In other words, don't even get near it. Because you know what happens when you get close to temptation? What happens? Okay, yeah, I'll have one more. Maybe your temptation's a sugar cookie. I don't know. You know better. Just saying. So don't even avoid it. Don't even get near it. Do not travel on that path, He says. Turn away from it and pass on. For they do not sleep, the wicked, they do not sleep unless they have done evil. And their sleep is taken away unless they make someone fall, unless they cause mischief for others. For they eat the bread of wickedness and drink the wine of violence. Well, there are other people that choose not to follow wisdom's path, and they're on that path. It leads to destruction for themselves, trouble for others. Verse 18, but the path of the just is like the shining sun that shines ever brighter unto the perfect day. Isn't that neat? the path of wisdom is light. We ever hear anything else like that in the Bible? John chapter 1, we're told Christ came, he was light, and the world is darkness. They did not want the light. And so again, here's this light and darkness metaphor again. Ancient times, Christ's time, and it's still pertinent to us today. But the path of the just is like the shining sun that shines ever brighter into the perfect day. The way of the wicked is like darkness. They do not know what makes them stumble. In other words, the wicked are blind. Blind, leading the blind in the ways of darkness, in darkness, without wisdom. And so again, verse 20 to 27, he again then enters. He says, "Righteousness, wisdom, righteousness, obedience to God, wickedness, disobedience, not the way of wisdom." And then he exhorts 20:27, give attention, listen to me, pay attention. They are words of life, verse 22. Verse 23, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life. Diligence just isn't work. It's just, I mean, you know, employers love diligent employees, don't they? You know, if you go to have your car worked on, don't you like a mechanic that's diligent? He works hard to make sure he solves the problem for you. But diligence is more than just the doing. Diligence requires a heart that's earnest and sincere and is working hard with the best intentions whatsoever to do the very best job capable. Keeping your heart with diligence means you will put all your effort sincerely, doing your best, really doing your best, to obey God, to follow wisdom. Out of it, out of the heart, spring the issues of life. And of course, the heart, we also connect with the mind, our conscience, or the choices we make. That's the starting point for so much of our actions, our conscientious actions. Put away from you a deceitful mouth, verse 24, and put perverse lips far from you. You know, what we say comes from our heart. You know, sometimes we say things, something slips out of our mouths, and where did that come from? Okay, looks like you just got a red flag. You better go back and open up the file cabinet of your life and start going through the files. Why did I just say that? There's something in me that's not right. I should not have said that. Okay? So there's something in the heart. Things pop out of our mouths sometimes because there's something wrong and pops out. Kind of like a frog jumps out of our mouth sometimes. It's like, ooh, where did that ugly thing come from? You better go back and find out if you got a dark, dank, little ugly pond in your heart somewhere that you need to clear out and get right. That was a terrible metaphor. Anyway, there you go. So put away from you a deceitful mouth, put perverse lips far from you. Let your eyes look straight ahead. In other words, don't go looking off in the swampy, fetid ditches of darkness, of temptation and wickedness. Let your eyelids look right before you. Ponder the path of your feet. You know, be aware of what you're doing, where you're going in life. Are you on the path of wisdom or on your path of wickedness? Let all your ways be established. Of course, you want your ways to be established in wisdom, the ways of God, obedience to God. Do not turn to the right or to the left, because you've already chosen wisdom, the Father's suggesting, remove your foot from evil. So keep to the path of wisdom. And again, so when we read in Matthew 7:14, Christ is talking about two paths. He's teaching what's been in Scripture, and it's the two paths, two ways of life, obedience, disobedience. It's all interconnected. It's all consistent. Proverbs chapter 5, we move a little more deeper into this father-son conversation. Dads know how boys think. They may not always admit it, but we do. And here we move into an admonition to avoid seduction to evil. Avoid seduction to evil. Some scholars call this chapter the man-to-man talk. Father to son. The man-to-man talk, father to son. And it's warning about, specifically the physical level, it's warning against liaisons with loose women, with wicked women. And of course, on the spiritual realm, it applies that we must be loyal to woman wisdom, lady wisdom, and not dapple with woman folly, the strange woman, who oftentimes is depicted as an adulteress. Okay? Verse 1 through 2, my son, pay attention to wisdom. Again, I'm going to tell you, here's some more wisdom, son, get ready for it. Listen to what I'm going to say to preserve your, you may preserve discretion, you may protect your life, your reputation, your happiness. So verse 3 through the end of this chapter, we pretty much get this description about how with wisdom we need to avoid seduction by the temptress, you might say. Verse 3, for the lips of an immoral woman, the strange woman that is contrary to woman wisdom, for the lips of an immoral woman drip honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil. How many times do we see commercials on TV, right? What are they selling? They're selling boxes of crackers, and they'll have this woman with these glossy lips, you know, and it's just craziness. If you can pull yourself back and analyze this from a marketing point of view, you know exactly what they're trying to sell you. If you want to look good, if you want to feel like you're better than ever, eat these crackers like this beautiful person is doing. Now, of course, they're using men, male models the same way. Tempting is tempting, I guess. Look at these lips, the lips of a moral woman. They drip honey. Her mouth is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lay hold of hell, the grave. Lest you ponder her path of life, don't think about going that way. Her ways are unstable. You do not know them. This tells us the father has not lived a life following the temptress, this immoral woman. And he's telling his son, I know, son, you're going to think you know what the world's like. You're going to think, oh, I can handle her, Dad. I'm good. I'm smart. And the father says to this young man, you do not know them, know her ways. Stay away from her. This idea of lips that drip honey and smooth as oil, it's talking about flattery. It's talking about temptation. And it's also very insightful about the male psychology. Men love flattery, especially from women. The words, there's something, men, I'm going to give away a secret, ladies. Men look very tough. We have this tough outer exterior, right? Guys, sit up straight. Look, okay, there you go. Okay, see what I mean? But inside, most of us are very insecure, very unsure of ourselves. And so when we have a young lady say some positive, nice things about us, what does it do, guys? You don't want to admit it. Suddenly we want to strut a little bit more than normal. You know, that feels good. We love flattery. We love flattery. We love compliments. And by the way, flattery is different from giving a compliment. Okay? Flattery is different from encouragement. Flattery you give people because you're trying to manipulate somehow. So be careful of flattery. That's manipulative. But words of encouragement, that's different. The purpose behind encouraging words, we all, young men, young ladies, we all need encouragement. But I think the flattery can go both ways. Be careful of flattery, the motivation behind it. But in this case, he's speaking father to son, and he's warning him, be careful of flattery of the women. Verse 4, we get this idea, but in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. You get the idea here that, young man, after you succumb to the flattery of the seductress, of this foreign woman, you're going to regret it. She's going to lead you into sin. And ultimately, you're going to condemn yourself. You're going to feel awful about yourself. You're going to wish you had never listened. And of course, this immoral woman, we could say this might be a personification of temptation, of doing the wrong thing, of going the way of wickedness. And if we've ever given into temptation, I think we understand what the father is telling his son. You're going to regret it. You're going to regret it. Her way of life is destruction ultimately. Therefore, hear me now, my children. Here he's kind of addressing all his kids. You get the sense, quite possibly, the little boys and little girls, all his family. And of course, it applies to all of us. Do not hear me now, my children, and do not depart from my words, the words of my mouth. Remove your way far from her. Avoid her. Get away from her. Do not go near the door of her house. Well, that sounds like we know where temptation lives, do we?
Oh, yeah.
We know exactly where she lives. And we're told, don't go near, stay out of that neighborhood. Just get away from it. Lest you give your honor to others and your years to the cruel one. Lest aliens be filled with your wealth and your labors go to the house of a foreigner. And you mourn at last when your flesh and your body are consumed. And then you will say, how I hate it. And so what he's saying is, if you follow in this way of the temptress, the immoral woman, this way that is contrary to the way of wisdom, ultimately, it's a personification of the way of wickedness, contrary to God. You might be tempted by position, by power. You might be tempted by prosperity, reputation, greed, whatever it is. If you live that way of life, the Father's time, the Son, you will come to a point in life where you're going to hate yourself. Maybe years down the road, as you're alone on facing the ultimate end, your death, you may stop and look back, and you may say something like this, verse 12, how I have hated instruction, and my heart despised correction. You're going to be filled with regret, the Father's telling his Son. You're going to say, I have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor did I incline my ear to those who instructed me. I was on the verge of total ruin in the midst of the assembly and congregation. There's going to be a time, and maybe this is also a bit of hope the Father's suggesting. You're going to come to a point, you're going to recognize what you did not do, and you're going to be filled with regrets. But you know, when you're at a point of regret, you're also at a point of being very close to doing what else? You come to a point where you can see you regret what you've done. You're on the verge of repentance. Follow it through. I was on the verge of total ruin in the midst of the assembly and congregation. Maybe that suggests that you came to your senses before you were totally destroyed, before you totally destroyed yourself. Ultimately, the best thing the Father says to do is just don't go that way. Avoid her. Don't cave into her. Don't let your life end in bitter regret because you followed the way of the temptress, the woman folly, foolishness, instead of woman wisdom. And then he carries on this idea. Now he sets up this allegory, as it were, verses 15 through 20. And this is the part where he gets a little bit more of this man-to-man talk. Man-to-man talk. But it's really parent-to-child talk about one of the most beautiful things God allows to humanity, but that can be easily destroyed and ruined, and it will ruin us in many ways if we do not pay close attention. Verses 15 through 20, let's just read through this, and then I'm going to come back, and we're going to interpret, analyze, explain a little bit what's going on here. Verse 15, drink water from your own cistern. A cistern is like a catch pool where rainwater would be caught. Individual homes had their own little cisterns, typically. And, of course, a parallel meaning here helps you understand a well. Drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? Let them be only your own and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times and always be enraptured with her love. For why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman and be embraced in the arms of a seductress? Any guesses as to what he's talking about? He's talking about sexual relationship. That's what he's talking about. And he's using metaphor. In a very poetic way. So let's go back here. The admonition here in verses 15 through 20 in particular, and then he goes on with it the last few verses here in this chapter. The admonition here is to stay true to your wife. And what he's saying is what you've heard probably growing up in the church all your life. The sexual relationship is one of those beautiful things God has created between a man and a woman, but is to be only in marriage. It's only to be in marriage. It's something most precious to be shared with no one else but your spouse. And of course, we're going to learn more about that in Song of Solomon. The idea of verse 15, drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well, it's talking about privacy. There's something very intimate and private that's to be going on between a husband and his wife. And remember, who's he talking to? His young son, who one of his first goals in life is to get married, find the right person to marry. And so he's telling him right off, right as he starts here, drink water from your own well. The cistern well refers more, it's a metaphor for the wife's sexual charms. That's something very precious that is his in marriage. In the fountains and streams of water, we see in verse 16, that refers to the husband's sexual affections for his wife. They're both to be shared only with their spouse. And so the father's telling the son, drink water, you know your wife, you know, we can use the old King James, to know, they knew one another. Know only your wife, sexually speaking. And again, he emphasized that verse 16. Should your fountains, in other words, should your sexual affections be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? In other words, your sexual affections should be for your wife at home. You shouldn't be spreading your, giving yourself to women in the streets away from home. And you get this sense of streams of water. Some translations say channels of water in the streets. Almost get a sense of, you know, the public gutter, water running down the gutter of the streets. That's not where you should be sharing your sexual favors, your sexual affections. That's with your wife, and your wife with you. Let them be only your own and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain, he's saying the young man, let who and what you are be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth. As a loving deer and a graceful doe, let her breast, let that intimate relationship with your wife satisfy you at all times. Always be enraptured with her love. For why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman? And remember, he's already given us a picture of her with this, her lips dripping honey and her flattery smoother than oil and the bitterness that ultimately comes from that. So again, the emphasis here, the father, and he's getting to the core. See, this is what makes the relationship in a family between husband and wife so personal, so intimate. It's key. It's absolutely key. Seek sexual gratification only with your spouse, or here it's father, son, only with your wife, not with some woman or women that are shared with all sorts of other men in the streets. Doesn't that make it sound really sordid, gross, and kind of dirty? Yeah. Don't do that, he says. Don't do that. Sex and heterosexual marriage is the only sexual relationship God allows, and He will bless it. He will bless it. Love your wife and build a close relationship with your wife. That is the way, a way of wisdom. So do not succumb to strange women. Do not share your affections with women who are held by others. And of course, it doesn't take much for us to understand that this also has a spiritual message, doesn't it? There's spiritual ramification. Spiritually, it bears the meaning of our intimacy we must have with God, spiritually speaking. Christ is going to return. There's a marriage of the Lamb. And so there's that point here. There's a spiritual ramification that we would understand as well. James 4:4, you can jot this down. James 4:4. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. So there's that same principle. Be intimate with God. Make God our most intimate spiritual relationship. So there's some parallel meaning here as well. Yes. 1 Corinthians 6:15-20. Paul speaking to the Corinthians, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. flee sexual immorality. So there's this connection between sexual morality with our spiritual relationship with God as well. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, or which is in you, whom which you have from God, and you are not your own? We are not our own. You know, when you are married, when you're in a marital relationship, your body is not yours. It belongs to your wife, and vice versa. And his body belongs to you, wives. In our relationship with God, we belong to him. We are his. We're not supposed to be having spiritual relationships with, you know, false gods, false religion, things like that. For you were bought at a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. So the way of wisdom, both in a physical level and spiritual level, it's to be very intimate, it's to be very close, and it's to be absolutely loyal, absolute loyalty and faithfulness. No playing the field is kind of a sordid metaphor today. None of that. And what happens if you do go that way? Verse 21 through 23 kind of sums it up. For the ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he ponders all his paths. We get the emphasis of Father's warning the Son, if I can't scare you to do what's right, so to speak, well, then maybe you should realize that God is going to judge you. God is watching everything we do. And he says, verse 22, his own iniquities, one's own iniquities entrap the wicked man, and he is caught in the cords of his sin. He shall die for lack of instruction, because he didn't listen to instruction, and in the greatness of his folly, folly means when you reject wisdom, he shall go astray. So in essence, lack of self-control sexually will lead to our destruction. It ruins our reputation. Our reputation can be so quickly destroyed. And that's especially true nowadays. How quickly are people's reputations destroyed nowadays? How long does it take for one's reputation to be destroyed when the truth gets out? It take a few days for the truth to get out, to be known? How long does it take for truth to get out? The truth of your sin, like that. How is that possible? Well, we always heard of that thing, a little bird told me. You ever heard of that expression? Yeah, it's called Twitter nowadays. Twitter, that little bird. People's sins quickly get out there instantaneously. There's also something called Facebook, and I know Facebook's getting kind of old-fashioned now. What, Instagram? And all sorts of social media. And if you've ever had to endure high school, you quickly understand how quickly your reputation can be destroyed because of a bad choice. Now, I will also add this, ladies and men. Do not get the idea here, as some feminist scholars will say, Proverbs, the Bible, make women the source of all wickedness. It's always the women doing the bad things. No, 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 no. God is not a respecter of persons, right? This warning goes both ways. Women are not the sole retainers, the sole source of things that are sinful and immoral. Men are too. We all are as human beings. Symbolically and culturally, in this ancient time, Solomon used this metaphor of the immoral woman to represent temptation and sin. Nowadays, in our more enlightened age, right, we have men trying to, you can look, just look at advertising today, right? We have men doing to the young women, the women in our society, as advertising campaigns have been doing with women towards men for decades. It's all becoming very sordid and wicked, and we must be aware of that. Proverbs 6. Proverbs 6, we can go a little more quickly through here. Proverbs 6, the father shifts gears a little bit. He's had this man-to-man talk, and now he shifts. It's kind of like, okay, that's the core. Now let's look at other things you need to avoid here, other foolish ways of foolishness you need to avoid. Verses 1 through 5, chapter 6, I'm going to summarize this a little bit. One of the things, of all the foolish things to avoid, son, verse 1 through 5, you want to avoid unwise promises or commitments. Avoid unwise promises or commitments. And so he says briefly here, my son, verse 1, if you become surety for your friend, or if you pledge. Nowadays, I think we might say, if you become a co-signer, you know what it means to co-sign? Let me put it this way. If you had, okay, go ahead, tell me, Gabe.
A co-sign is when two people sign the same contract and they're both equally responsible to pay for that contract. And if one doesn't, then the other one has to pay for the other person.
Right. It falls on you. That's part of what's going on there. It's as if one person doesn't, maybe can't pay off the loan, so you sign saying, well, if he fails to do it, I'll take care of it. The father is telling his son, be careful of unwise promises and commitments. And the reason is, you will be snared by the words of your mouth, verse 2. You are taken by the words of your mouth. In other words, you're going to put yourself in jeopardy. He's not saying don't make promises with people. Don't make long-term commitments like that. But he's saying as a principle, it might be a good idea to avoid doing that. We might say something akin to don't promise what you may not want to deliver or can't deliver. And so that can get you in trouble. Verse 5, he says, if you do find yourself in that situation, he tells his son, you know, plead with your friend, try to get it out of that arrangement. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter. Now, part of that is culturally background. What would happen to you in that ancient time if you or your friend failed to pay off a debt? What might happen to you? Do you know? Go ahead.
Become a slave to them?
That's right. Not only do you become a slave to them, you could be sold into slavery. Literally, you would become a slave. Now, today, what happens if you fail to pay off your credit card? Will they throw you in slavery today? No. I guess if you really are outrageous, they could actually put you in jail if you're just terrible about it. But in a sense, you become a slave to the credit card company. They will forever harass you, skim your wages, whatever it takes. Don't raise your hand, but sometimes student loans right now are like that. I've known people that they've been professors for 30 years and they're still paying off their school loans. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. They become enslaved. They can never get out from underneath that loan. I'm not saying don't do loans. I've got some loans, car loans, and had mortgage and all that. But just be very careful, and you want to avoid that. Don't be so quick to co-sign to make these long-term commitments. And that's good advice, especially for this young man starting out. Verse 6 through 11, here's another thing to avoid, another foolish way to avoid. Oh, I can relate to this one. Avoid laziness. Avoid laziness. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Oh, I don't want to be called a sluggard. That sounds like a slug. I don't want that. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. It's interesting. The ant's so feminine. Which having no captain, overseer, or ruler, provides her supplies in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber? I used to tell myself, how long will you slumber, O student? When will you rise from your sleep? That's when I was a college student. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, and so your poverty shall come on you like a prowler, and your need like an armed man. Laziness can lead to unexpected poverty. But there's some things he's not saying. He's saying the ant is busy when it's time to be busy. You see, she's gathering her supplies in the summer, in harvest time. The ant is a good example. When it's time to be busy, when it's time to be doing, she's doing. Some people look at this and say, we get this, some of us in our culture background, our family background, it's in my family, we're perfectionists, we're workaholics, and it will drive you crazy if you let it. And my mother to this day, she's 85 years old, and she says, I don't feel like I've earned my keep today. She has to do something. And mom, you don't have to worry about painting the house or whatever you're doing, mother. You know, we'll take care of it. But that's not what it's saying. It's not saying don't have time for leisure. It's not saying don't have time to relax and don't have time to rest. It's saying when it's time to be busy, it's time to be busy. The ant's not sleeping when it's time to be harvesting. That's the principle. Laziness can lead to unexpected poverty. Now, as a Christian, I've made this point. We don't want to be lazy in our relationship with God. We don't want to be lazy about our prayer life. Well, that's critical. And it's so easy to push that aside. You're running late, something happens. It's so easy to let that become a bad, lazy habit. Laziness, we're told, verse 11, can be worse than a thief. Laziness can steal away from us what is most precious, our time, time for doing important things. Verse 12 through 15 is a warning to avoid the wicked man, the troublemaker, those people who are untrustworthy. And we can be pretty good about seeing, recognizing those people. If you ever went to, gone to public school, or you got a job, you see how other employees work, or maybe you've been to college, you kind of know, you kind of learn who the people are you don't really want to spend a lot of time with. Sometimes it's because they bring out the worst in you. You know, it's not so much them, it's what they draw out of you that you may not like. So he says, a worthless person, a wicked man, walks with a perverse mouth. He winks with his eyes. You know, nowadays, he shuffles his feet. What does that mean, he shuffles his feet? I had a student a couple years ago ask me, is it wrong to wink your eye? Is it wrong to shuffle your feet? I always told my kids, pick up your feet. You're wearing out your shoes. Sounds like a parent. Is it wrong to point? What's he talking about? These are people whose motivation is not very good. They're shuffling, they're loitering, they're kind of looking for trouble. They're winking, they're giving secret codes, it's innuendo, they're trying to get something. They're pointing, they're mocking, they're pointing fault in other people. See, there's perversity in that person's heart and devising evil continually. These are people that sow discord. You and I know people like this growing up, and we're going to be around people like that. The father wisely is telling his son, be aware of those people, avoid them. Now, we have to be light in darkness. We have to shine our light, yes, and we're going to be around people like that, but it doesn't mean we want to become like them. After I came in the church, I gave up a lot of things. I gave up cussing. I gave up bad language, bad jokes. And my friends noticed. I no longer use the blue-lettered words and all that anymore. And I didn't hang out with them like I used to. What was interesting is the influence I had on them. I didn't recognize on that. Guess what happened when I'd come into the room? They changed. They stopped telling dirty jokes. They stopped using, you know, the four-letter words, because I never say anything about it. They just recognized I didn't do that. And they, I don't know if it shamed them or whatever. They just, maybe it was respect, I don't know. But they just stopped doing that. So, you know, we don't want to associate, we don't want to be like those people, but at the same time, we are to be light. So it's, I think there's another side of it. We can be maybe a positive impact on them in a way too. But we want to avoid being like that. Verse 16 to 19, here are some things, here's a list of things to avoid. The foolish things, these are things that God hates. And then we'll stop for the day. These six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are abomination to Him. It is a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among brethren. That sounds like people that cause trouble in their own family. These are things God hates. In other words, these seem to be seven personal attitudes or approaches that God hates to see in people. Proud look, you know, haughtiness. You know what haughty means? That arrogant look. That look of superiority. You're so stupid. You know, I can't even believe I stand by you. You know, that kind of attitude. God hates that arrogance, that pride. Tongue of deception or a lying tongue. God hates lies. The murder of innocence. Hands that shed innocent blood. Some translations read murder of innocence. Of course, I can't help it. Nowadays, I think of abortion, but also the innocents such as Abel, back in the beginning, after the Garden of Eden. Plotting of evil, the eagerness to do evil. A false witness who speaks lies, that's perjury. Boy, that doesn't happen anymore, does it? Don't read about that in the news. For causing trouble among our brethren. What we have here is something I'll talk to you more about, but this becomes a type of proverb we see. It's like a riddle, verses 16 through 19, or a numerical saying. Six things, yes, a seventh thing. It's like a formula that some of the proverbs come in. And it kind of builds, it gives us all these things. They don't always build to a climactic statement or crescendo at the end, but it does provide a list of things, a memorable list of things for as individuals we need to avoid. All right, so there we go. We'll end there, and we'll proceed apace tomorrow. Have a good day. Stay warm and be